Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome. This is MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me, Jeremy Mags, as I explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and straight to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program today, amid threats of withdrawing support during the budget vote, unhappiness about the land expropriation bill and the National Health Insurance Scheme, could the Democratic Alliance exit the government of national unity? And an extended interview with the Minister of Environment about climate change talks at the recent World Economic Forum in Davos, as well as the way forward for South Africa's own ambitions towards a carbon neutral future. It's Monday, January the 27th. Is it fair to say that South Africa's government of national unity is facing one of its most serious tests yet? The Democratic Alliance has declared a formal dispute over the expropriation bill as well as the National Health Insurance Bill, citing concerns over property rights and economic viability. So, could this be the beginning of the end, or is there some room, some degree for compromise? Joining us now with a closer look at the political and economic implications of this dispute from the Brenthurst Foundation, Ray Hartley, a very warm welcome. The Democratic Alliance has framed its opposition to these bills, in its words, as a red line. How serious, in your opinion, is this dispute? What's at stake here for both the ANC and the DA?
Hi, Jeremy. Yeah, I think this is the most serious threat to the continuation of the GNU that we have seen because of the words that have been used and the way it's been described. So I think it's an accumulation of a series of legislation, signing in of legislation that has taken place without consulting the opposition. And, you know, at some point, they're going to want to know what's the point of being in the GNU if the ANC just does whatever it wants to do. So it looks to me like it's fairly serious. I do think that there is within the DA, certainly, and elsewhere, and probably within a large part of the ANC, a recognition that the GNU has to continue, that the dividend that has come already from the GNU so far, just in terms of financial stability, global kind of acceptance of or renewed enthusiasm for South Africa and so on, is so big that it would take something extraordinary to make that break.
Ray, given that these bills were already in motion before the formation of the GNU, do you think the DA might have miscalculated its ability to influence legislation?
Yeah, I think it believed that everything would have to be renegotiated. It's a new government. It's a different government to what was in office before. I think nobody would expect Donald Trump to sign into law legislation that had been, initiated by Joe Biden, because it's a different government and it will take a different approach. So even though the ANC was in the previous government and is still a part of the GNU, it is not a continuation of the previous government. It's a break with that government, and it's a new governance administration in place. So it's a bit disingenuous, I think, for the ANC to believe that it can continue with the legislative program that it had when it had a majority, just willy-nilly, and impose that on the others.
It's fair to say, Ray, that this dispute, as you've outlined, is about policy, but it's also surely about broader political power dynamics within the unity government, and this was always inevitable, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think particularly within the ANC, because I think that, I don't think people are aware of the compressed timeline that we're in here. I mean, in 2 years and 10 months, Cyril Ramaphosa will no longer be the president of the ANC. And the previous record shows that once somebody else takes over, they want the presidency of the country before the next election. That's always been the case with Zuma and Mbeki and with Ramaphosa himself and Zuma. So Ramaphosa is on a pretty short timeline here. He'll be gone and will no longer be the person calling the shots. And in the period leading up to that, of course, his influence wanes because he doesn't promise any kind of future gratification for support that he receives. So I think that compressed timeline, along with the rise of this populist kind of rebellion against the government of national unity within the ANC, is causing Ramaphosa, I think, to try and get away with these sort of showman-like acts of, signing into law this legislation.
Ray, there've got to be pressure valves within the setup itself. So how does the ANC and the DA, how do they go about starting to fix this then?
Well, I think that they have fixed something fairly big, although there's a lot of contention about whether or not it is properly fixed. So the disagreement over the Bella legislation in the education sector was pretty vociferous. And they used the GNU mechanism, and they resolved that essentially by agreeing to sign it into law, but allowing that the minister, who happens to be a DA minister, would then be in charge of formulating the regulations for implementation. So offering the opposition an opportunity to perhaps ameliorate the worst parts of that legislation. So there's an example of how it should be done, even though in that particular case, initially, the opposition was ignored. But ultimately, the mechanism did come into play. Now, these other pieces of legislation, the NHI and the expropriation bill, this did not occur. This is simply the ANC asserting itself and saying, we're going to do this and be damned.
Just a final question. The Democratic Alliance today arguing that these bills will harm investment and economic growth. Already today, we've seen both the Rand and the JSE on the back foot. The business community is going to be nervous about this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the assumption post the formation of the GNU has been that there's a rationality that's returned to financial economic management within government. And this is the first proper real suggestion that might not be the case. So, for example, the finance ministry has failed completely to budget for the NHI, for example. There's no money set aside for it. There's no plan, and yet it's being pushed ahead, and this means that that money will be taken away from other programs or be raised through borrowing. So it's a kind of it's a sort of break, really, with the proper fiscal approach to these things. I think expropriation has its own threats to property, to industrial property, etc., mining, and so on.
I'm going to leave it there. Ray Hartley from the Brenthurst Foundation, always appreciate the analysis. Thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the world's political and business elites present in Davos last week facing an uncompromising address from the UN chief Antonio Guterres as he rounded on a lack of multilateral collaboration in what he termed was an increasingly rudderless world at risk, he said, from two existential dangers. One was climate change and the other was unregulated artificial intelligence. Let's focus on climate change. Likening fossil fuel addiction to Frankenstein's monster, sparing nothing and no one, The Secretary General reminded world leaders that they have to keep their promise to produce new economy-wide national climate action plans well before the event. So where do we stand in South Africa? This past weekend, in an extended interview, I spoke to our Environment Minister, Dion George, who was just back from Switzerland.
So, Minister, first of all, just back from Davos, I wonder maybe as a starting point and a general one, can you give me a sense of the attitude towards climate change at the event? Is there any new thinking emerging? Are there new concerns that are being expressed? What did you discern?
I think not much has changed. I mean, we've recently had COP and then there were agreements that were made. But of course, the big issue is the United States of America. As we know, President Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement. And of course, there is concern now, what does that actually mean? I mean, obviously, in terms of the financing, because the US was a big financier of the UNFCCC. But Michael Bloomberg has now said that he would fund that. So that's positive. And also various states in America have said that they will continue with their initiatives, even if the federal government is not going to do that. So generally, the mood was very, very good in terms of us making some progress. Also, a lot of concerns about the fact that it seems to be speeding up. I mean, we're seeing a lot of negative weather events, etc., and our ability to adapt to it is absolutely weak. That is generally the view. And of course, remember, it's an economic forum, so it's all about the money, really. So there was a lot of conversations about climate financing. And then, of course, South Africa's big piece for the G20 is the cost of capital. So I had lots of really, really good conversations. I never had an opportunity to speak to my US counterparts on climate. I don't think that they were actually there.
Minister, let's just stay with the Paris Agreement for the moment, though, whichever way you look at it. And in spite of the fact that there is some commitment to continue with funding, this is a huge setback, though, isn't it?
Yes, I do think so. I actually did issue a statement as the Minister for Forestry, Fisheries and Environment, expressing my disappointment that the US has chosen this route, because at COP29, of course, we did actually have an agreement that was made and the US was part of it. So the US withdrawing does make a big difference, especially because we have to see what their behavior is going to be, because I mean, you know, if they're going to increase their emissions very significantly, which it sounds like they might well do, that definitely does have an impact. And of course, South Africa, we know we are emitting too much. We do want to manage that and we've got plans in place. But at least, you know, we are walking in the right direction. But if a country starts to really walk very fast in the other direction, then you create a vacuum. And then the question is, well, what happens in that vacuum? What fills that vacuum? Interestingly, it is China is one of the biggest emitters as well, but they're moving very fast on getting a greener economy going. So it will be very interesting to see how China moves and then, of course, how America moves, because they might be diverging a lot on how they're sourcing their energy. So definitely the geopolitical plates are shifting. There's no doubt about that.
Minister George, were there any new commitments or were there any new observations as far as the funding then of South Africa's just energy transition is concerned?
Yes, we had a lot of conversations specifically around the cost of capital. Now, as I mentioned, one of the big issues for South Africa as the president of the G20 is looking at the cost of capital. And there is, in fact, a cost of capital commission. So I was talking to a number of countries regarding why it is that South Africa is considered to be such a risky destination in terms of investment, which makes capital more expensive for us when there is, in fact, a war going on in Europe. Now, of course, it's all about the state of our national balance sheet. And that, of course, then impacts directly on the cost of capital if we're going to borrow any. So I have started already a project to cost our natural assets so that we can add that onto the national balance sheet, because that would actually make our balance sheet look a lot stronger, because it actually is a lot stronger than it appears, because we've got biodiversity that's not actually costed. Brazil started raising this last year. So in my conversations, I've been talking about if we have got our natural assets on our national accounts, how does that then change the picture? Because obviously then our balance sheet is stronger And that means that we would technically be eligible for less interest payments on any borrowing that we do. Also, we'd be able to see how can we then develop our carbon markets, because we can now, because of the agreement that was made in Baku, South Africa's lots of green possibilities in that respect. So I'm also looking at starting to develop a carbon market now that we can. I had discussions also with the Minister of Finance while I happened to be there, as I did with the Energy Minister. So being there was also very useful from that respect. But the key thing is that countries are sitting up and listening, as are the banks, the big financial institutions are looking up, sitting up and looking at South Africa, because, of course, we've got the limelight on us because of the G20, but also because of the fact that we are raising these things very strongly that haven't necessarily been at the forefront before. So that was a new conversation, was a very exciting one. And certainly in the meetings that I had where I spoke, I had almost unanimous agreements, especially from my other African countries, who actually came up and said, well, thank you so much for raising this issue, because it's a big issue for us. And of course, South Africa now at the forefront of it. So it is a new conversation, and it's a very exciting one, because I also met with Prince William's team that was there specifically around supporting rangers, etc. And they have offered some assistance to me and Sanby, where we've already started putting the cost together for the national assets, natural assets.
Minister, it's a Herculean task, though. You will agree with me in that respect. How do you go about doing that? And what sort of timeline have you set yourself, given the urgency that you've put to this project?
Well, I think the key thing is you've got to start somewhere. So as I mentioned, Sanby has actually started doing that already, to say, well, look, what do we have in terms of our biodiversity? Also speaking to countries like Brazil and Chile, because they've started to do the same, to say, look, we are, because we've got the jungle in Brazil, for example, we are then contributing towards mitigating against climate change. What value does that actually have? Also, the Bangladesh delegation raised the issue that because they're at the end of a delta and rubbish comes down their river stream towards the ocean, how do you actually cost the benefit that they've got there, where they're receiving the rubbish because it's coming from upstream? So how do you cost that in? So it's a very exciting way of looking at how you value the things that you have, given the world is changing so rapidly. Also, very interestingly, I put onto the table the question is, like, you know, everybody takes for granted safe passage around the southern tip of Africa. I mean, you know, if you didn't have that, what would that mean to global trade, for example? Now, of course, we South Africa make sure that it's a very free a place to go. But if it wasn't, what would it look like? So these are all value adds, enormous value adds to the world that aren't necessarily costed. So as you were alluding to, it's obviously a huge concept. And also, it's also a lot of work to be done. And also, I think the thing is, where it's landed very nicely was that the companies that were all there, and these are really big companies from across the world, the CEOs, etc., and they were talking about corporate social responsibility being falling out of favor a little bit, etc. But the concept of fairness for consumers, etc., is like, well, you know, we know that the international financial infrastructure is not working so well for the developing economies like South Africa and our region and the continent. So how do we get a fairer world? And I think that's quite a big thing, becoming more and more of an issue, like, well, what is fair? And what is not fair is the system as it works now, which heavily skewed towards the developed economy countries, when we get left behind. And then we're in a situation where we actually can't move ahead because we're stuck with a lot of debt around our neck. So that was a very, very constructive conversation. Also, we spoke a lot about the UN plastic treaty that's being that's in the mix at the moment, because we haven't got to an actual agreement on it. But a lot of the countries and a lot of the companies were also talking about that, because of course many of them are manufacturers of plastic. So we had quite a lot of discussions on that. And also, because South Africa is the president of the G20, the question was, well, how will we accelerate that? Obviously, we haven't signed it yet, there's a number of issues that we need to consider. But that was also quite a big thing. But it's also about the money, in terms of how do you pay to clean up your environment? Because generally, the oceans are very heavily polluted. Many countries are heavily polluted, including our own. How do you create a business model that then drives it? Because if it doesn't make sense financially, it's not going to happen. Even if you force people to do stuff, it won't happen because there's no money for it. So that actually fitted in quite nicely also into the climate debate.
Minister, if I can pull you back to your comments about carbon markets. Obviously, there is concordance that it's an essential tool for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but you'll concede it does come with many risks, market volatility, regulatory and policy risks, and also greenwashing and fraud. How much more work needs to be done in that respect before you can start introducing a concept like this?
A lot of work needs to be done. My department is responsible for working on the carbon markets and also on the sector emission targets. I had a chat with the Minister of Finance while I was there as well, and he said to me, look, he's basically going to lean very heavily on my department for that because we are the main drivers of it. But it is so, as you say, is that we have to actually do it quite cautiously because we don't want to have unintended consequences. So the whole idea is that you would be able to get some benefits for the green that you have, and because there are countries that are very interested in investing in that. For example, Saudi Arabia are very interested in investing in greening in South Africa and other places because they're not going to be able to mitigate on their own, given that they sit on so much fossil fuel. So we will tread cautiously on it, but we will move ahead. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And also, I've got a number of experts that can work on that. Also, very importantly, if we look at the natural assets that South Africa has, we must make sure that we can actually showcase enough what we have. So we do have a group of people that are coming to South Africa to have a look specifically at Isimangaliso, our World Heritage Site on the border of Mozambique. Obviously, that's it's a World Heritage Site. It has a huge amount of value. It's got a huge potential in terms of the fact that it's got the ocean over there, a carbon sink potential, etc. So that's a potential site as well that can bring quite a lot of benefits for us and also integrate the communities that are around it as well. I also had the chance to speak to Ray Dalio. Ocean X is going to come. The research vessel is going to come around also to Isimangaliso. So we are talking about making some movie over there because nobody knows about it, you know, and it's time for them to do that. So that was also a very worthwhile exchange that I have over there when we also spoke about illegal fishing, for example. How do we manage that particular concept? So it all hangs together, the climate change together with the biodiversity and the protection of the environment. It's all part of the same type of a conversation, except different parts of the coin because we've got different COPs for those.
But perhaps more difficult for South Africa and perhaps more political, Minister, given that there is the imperative to balance economic growth objective. You've spoken about international climate obligations. We have a heavy reliance on coal, but there's also the issue about doing all of that and not killing jobs.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very complicated situation, as you would know. I think, for example, now the big questions coming up with Eskom. I mean, at the moment, my department and me, we're being sued for decisions that were made by the former minister, Barbara Creasy, to give exemptions to Eskom on the power stations that are due to be decommissioned by 2030. And then, of course, the three big ones, Kusile, Medupi, and Tutuki. So that's the problem that we're facing now. The exemptions were given until the end of March 2025. Now, the question is, you know, what do you do? If, for example, there's an application for more exemptions, if it is granted, what does that mean? The atmosphere keeps getting dirtier or there's not enough mitigation against the emissions. But if there's firmer action taken, what happens then if you switch off a power station? Then you don't have your economy can't move in the dark. So we're in a very difficult position there. So what we have to do is to try to balance the economic imperatives that we need our economy to grow. It's not growing fast enough. We've got poverty, etc. How do you then do that within the same frame of then protecting your environment? There's also a big view that says, well, look, we've got 200 years worth of coal under the ground. So just dig it up and use it in the power stations. Now, if we're not going to do that, which obviously we're not going to do, then, well, what does that then mean to our economy? So we are in a very difficult position. But what we have agreed is that, and certainly my conversations with Minister Ramaphosa as well, is that, of course, we are moving in the right direction. It's taking us longer than we'd like to go. But we do need to go there because the climate change is, in fact, a really big problem and it's impacting on us and everybody else. So we want to be, you know, sensible participants. At the same time, we don't want our people to get further into poverty. So it's an incredibly difficult situation to go down. Also, because Eskom has not responded effectively, I mean, to the exemptions that Minister Creasy gave them, they have not moved fast enough on the decommissioning plans and, of course, mitigating the emissions. So these are just facts. And, of course, there's lots. It's going to get very noisy in the next couple of months. There's no doubt about that, because it's no doubt heading my way. And as the Minister of the Environment, these are very complicated decisions that need to be taken. So it's like a rock and a hard place in a way. But we have to move forward in some way. And we'll find a way. I mean, there's no other way, really. We have to move forward.
And in that respect, Minister, do you think that your voice is being heard, particularly when it comes to an issue like Eskom?
Yes, my voice is being heard. I mean, we have these meetings. We have the discussions, obviously, in the cabinet, which I don't talk about. But of course, I have discussions with my counterparts, specifically Minister Ramaphosa and, of course, Minister Mantashe. Minister Mantashe has particular views about mining. And I, of course, am the appeal authority on the mining. So, you know, we don't always agree on things. But yes, it is being heard. And certainly from where I am sitting as the Minister of the Environment, I am heard, and I have had and am having the conversations that are needed, and they're difficult. And I think that even if I was a minister from the ANC, for example, I think I'd be having a similar complexity. So yeah, it is just a difficult situation that we have inherited in a way, and we must move faster on. I did, in fact, meet, I didn't have a conversation with Eskom in Davos, but their CFO was there, and we, you know, he introduced himself to me, etc. And I said, I'm coming to see you very soon. So, and I'm going to do just that. So those are ongoing conversations. And I think that's what South Africa has to understand, is that we are in a really, really difficult situation. The world is changing rapidly. But what we have got going for our country is that we are a stable country, unlike many others, and that we are more or less walking in the same direction. And so that, I think, is an enormously big positive.
Minister, just one final question, if I can. Just reading the communiques coming out of Davos, there was no doubt that business leaders were reaffirming their commitment to climate action. In South Africa, though, is government thinking in any way about new incentivization to encourage businesses to transition to greener practices? Or is it time now that you start wielding a stick?
Well, I think if you look at our extended producer responsibility in terms of keeping the environment clean, I think that is definitely there in place. It's mandatory. And so we can put some pressure on companies also if we look at, for example, the carbon tax, because we've got CBAM coming up, remember. So if companies don't reach their emission targets, they're going to have to pay the CBAM. And that's going to be negative because we're going to have money moving from South Africa to the north, which you think about the carbon tax. Now, of course, nobody wants to increase tax, but we may well have to create a circular situation where to avoid CBAM, we might have to see an uptick in the carbon tax, but then we want to keep it in South Africa and then distribute it into the right place. So that's an incentive for business, I think, because they understand how it works. There's no doubt that our bigger companies do get that completely. So I think it's always better to try to work with an incentive rather than a stick. In all the conversations I've had with the business leaders in South Africa and many of them also in Davos, is they're all saying, yes, we absolutely want to. However, we need more transmission lines. We need better regulation. We need to be able to move faster to bring in more green energy because people are waiting to invest in it. And those are the conversation we need to have. We need to accelerate the transmission lines. We need more of them. That lies firmly in Eskom's purview. That needs to happen. And also, there is space for incentives for greener energy. There's more than enough money out there, I assure you. People are very excited about South Africa. They want to come, but we make it difficult for them. And I think that's one of my key responsibilities also. How do we actually make it easier to then crowd in that money? Because we must, and we really need it.
Just back from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Minister Dion George, Environment Minister, thank you very much indeed.
And that's also our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.